Okay, my name is Mary Jo, and I'm an alcoholic and drug addict. My sobriety date is May 8th, 1972. And I know I'm way too young to be sober that long. I literally was, when I came into AA, the only gal my age going. The other two women were old. They had to be at least, 45 or 50. So I am very grateful to be an alcoholic, and I spent all of my life, from the consciousness that I can remember a memory, of making sure that I never became an alcoholic. I didn't even know what it was. But my birth mother was a very severe alcoholic and had abandoned me when I was just a little over 2 years old. And I was adopted into this family that spoke of her as though I wasn't present in the room. So I heard a lot about who she was, how she was, and how bad she was. And so I was never going to be like her. And of course, as I got older, little by little, I began to do many of the same things that she had done that she'd been so judged for. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. What I want you to know about my life today is where I'd like to start. My life today is completely free of having any cravings for alcohol or drugs. My life is not free, completely free, of being a fear. I have lots of fears at different times. I was just sitting with my husband outside, who is also in the program. Is that okay if I said it? Too late now. I sat there watching all of you in these early weeks and months and years of sobriety, and what have I got to share with you? You know, who am I? What, you know? But the thing is that if I'm really working the program and I'm living one day at a time, whoever in this room got up before 10 o'clock this morning has more sobriety than I do. And we kind of chuckle about that, but it's really the truth. One day at a time, I practice these principles to my best ability, and I fail. I come short. But I have learned in the program that I get to start over my day any time I decide to. And so when I fall short, I try to own it, and I start again. And that was something that I wasn't allowed to do as a child. I was had to be perfect. I had to rise above my roots and come up to the standards of the family I was adopted into. They had two children of their own, boys, and I was a little doll that my mother wanted, but she didn't want to do another pregnancy. She just wanted a little girl. And she had very high standards set for me and what I was going to do in my life, and that would all look very good on her record as a mother when I accomplished all of these things. And I did accomplish quite a few things as a child. I'm kind of a weird duck in that way. I was considered a child prodigy on the piano and dancing and elocution, which you probably don't even know what that is, but it was very important back then. I see somebody back there grinning. You know what it is. Oh, my. So anyway, it wasn't fun in my house, and my mother was kind of a my adopted mother was kind of a sick little chicken herself. Her dad was a very severe drinking alcoholic, and she grew up very, very poor. So she carried around a great deal of shame, and I was her answer to absolving all that shame, and I fell far short, far, far short. She and I spent close to 20 years not speaking in my sobriety. It was the best I could do. I tried to be back in that world and maintain my sobriety, and it just didn't work. I couldn't do it. Now, again, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but let me tell you what it was when I first came into the program. At that point, I was taking every kind of diet pill I could find, and they were all legal at that time. I was on sleeping pills for taking too many diet pills during the day. I was drinking straight bourbon. That was my drink. I very snobbishly figured anybody that put anything into bourbon was, they just weren't real good drinkers. Two fingers of Jack Daniel's Black Label was my best beauty regimen. especially when I was putting makeup on. I can only imagine what I must have looked like. But I thought I looked great. And I didn't think I had a problem. I knew that I was a pretty sick little puppy because I'd spent about 5 or 6 trips to the local sanitarium. But, you know, I was an abused child. And I was manic depressive, which they don't use anymore, by the way. And I had schizoid tendencies. So I had a whole list of reasons to be as screwed up as I was. But alcoholic? No. I could quit drinking any time I wanted to. I quit all the time. It was in AA I found out about quitting drinking and staying quit. And boy, the day I heard that, I just about fell out of the chair. I was involved with Mr. AA. This was all happening in Richmond, Virginia. I had been married twice, and I had 3 children to take care of, and I was working. I had a very good job. I was going up through the ranks at Honeywell International, which today is this huge, huge megalopolis of technology, and I was in on the ground floor with that. And I was doing quite well. And I had a year and a half of sobriety, about that, close to that. And I had been going to Al-Anon for a year. I had about 6 months of sobriety. I went to Al-Anon because in dating Mr. AA, he decided to have me read the first 164 pages of the Big Book so that I would understand him. And if you don't hear the joke in that, let me say it again. I read the first 164 pages of the Big Book so that I would know how to deal with him and do what he needed me to do to help him stay sober. Well, I did a pretty good job. He never did use. But anyway, I really thought that at the time. I really didn't hear it. I did not hear a word in those first 164 pages about drugs. And I was into drugs more than I was drinking at that time. Because when I started dating him, it wouldn't be polite to date somebody like me if I was drinking. You know, I'd had to quit drinking. But I think I also knew at the same time that I couldn't control my drinking. And the rest of my life was filled with people that never said anything to me about my drinking or how much I drank. Everybody drank sort of like I did. So I had quit drinking, and I started going crazier. And so he asked me to go to Al-Anon again to stay pretty much on track so that I could be there for him. And I didn't understand. I was so grateful that he wanted to have anything to do with me that I went to Al-Anon. And I am today very, very grateful to Al-Anon. Al-Anon literally saved my life. And AA saved my soul. The night that I was going to go home and commit suicide, I had it all planned. I knew what I needed to do because I had suicided about 3 years earlier and had been pronounced. No, it was earlier. But anyway, I had been pronounced at that time, and I researched it and found out why I had not actually died. They went out and told my family I was dead, but I was taking my own breath, a breath on my own about every 30 seconds, they said. And then I just kept doing that. I didn't quit taking a breath every 30 seconds, so they had to go back out and tell my family I was going to live. And then they told my family, but she is brain damaged to the extent that you're going to have to put her on the back ward of the state hospital. So today when I act a little weird, I just blame it on my brain damage from then. I don't get away with it, but I still blame that one. And so I was going to go home a year into Al-Anon. About another 3 months. During that time in Al-Anon, my Mr. AA had been buying speed and pot for us to try or to use on the weekends recreationally. And because in that 164 pages that I read didn't say anything about drugs, I thought it was all right. But in Al-Anon in those days, it was like discussion meetings are today. You sit around the table and you talk. So I don't know that I can't talk about smoking pot and dropping acid and whatever. But the ladies in Al-Anon knew, and it kind of created a problem for everybody. And out of that, I decided that I had to die. I couldn't do any. I didn't have an answer. I didn't know what else to do. Now, I have 3 children. My son is now 13 at this point, and my daughters are 7 and 3. 8 and 3. The 8-year-old is the one that would come in the morning to wake me to get up to go to work. Never even considered. If I had carried through with my plan, she's the one that would have come in. Because in those days, my pain made me so self-centered and so selfish that I absolutely had no measure of thinking of anything but my own self and my own answers. So in God's world, we have angels that come and say, hey, let's sit down and have a cup of coffee. And that's exactly what happened. This lady came in from California. She understood about drugs, and she took me aside, and she told me her story. She didn't tell me I was doing anything wrong. She didn't criticize him. She told me her story. And when we finished, I said, well, my gosh, that's my story. So she said, well, what are you doing about it? And I said, well, actually, when you leave here, I'm getting ready to go back there and take all 6 of those bottles of pills, go to bed, and I'll wake up dead. She said, well, that is one thing you could do. I fully expected her to get all excited and try to talk me out of it. She didn't. She said, well, you could do that, but you could also try AA. I said, look, I love the people in AA. I love what I hear about AA, but I'm not an alcoholic. She said, where does it say that you have to say you're an alcoholic? And she had me. She said, the only requirement for membership is a desire not to drink, implied, that day. Well, she says, do you want to drink? And I said, no, I want to die, but I don't want to drink. What a waste. So she said, well, try AA for 6 months. And I said, all right. She said, do it exactly the way they tell you to do it. And if you don't like the results in six months' time, you can still carry through with your plan to die, and I won't try to stop you. Well, and as crazy as I was in that moment, that made sense. And that was May 7th of 1972, and May 8th, the next day, was a Monday, and that's when I began AA. I wasn't well enough because I immediately went into withdrawal, and that was not a pretty sight. And so it was several days before I actually got to a meeting. But when I got to the meeting, I was so ashamed and excited at the same time that I didn't have the balls to get up and get a desire chip when they tried to give them out. So after the meeting, I went downstairs. We had a clubhouse where the meetings were upstairs, and downstairs was a social room and a little secretary's office. And I went to the secretary and I said, you got one of those little white chips for me? And without even looking up from her desk, she just picked it up, handed it to me, and said, it's about time. And here, all this time, I had no idea anybody knew that I was struggling with that drugs and alcohol. That was one of the best days of my life. I want to tell you the second best days of my life, because I can tell you my story, and it's fairly entertaining. But these 2 days are the most important things I want to always remember. The second most important day of my life was 2 months later. I was really struggling with trying to stop lying. I was a pathological liar, according to the psychiatrist. So I guess I was. And I know I had lied all my life. And nobody trusted me. Nobody wanted to do anything with me or for me. I couldn't live life on any kind of a normal term. I could carry it off for a little while, and then I would blow it. So when I went into AA down there, this is in Richmond, Virginia, and we have it here too, you go around the room, everybody says their name, and you say, what? I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, and I knew I was going to burn in hell for lying, because I just didn't believe it. In those days, they had a pamphlet of 12 questions. You might be an alcoholic if you answer 4 of them. Yes. I answered 1 yes. I just could not process thought enough to be able to identify. And I wanted to be an alcoholic. And you know why? Because I saw that it worked. I went to these open meetings. I stopped going to Al-Anon almost entirely. But I saw AA work. And nothing else in my life had worked. My ex-husband, by that point, he had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on my psychiatric care. Wish I had that money back. But anyway, I just didn't believe it. But the first 2 months were tough, and listening to people tell their stories in AA. Few little discussion meetings, but mostly meetings, speaker meetings. I began to hear, well, you know, I could quit anytime I wanted, but, you know, I couldn't stay quit. Well, you know, I didn't drink in the morning. Oh, wait a minute. Let's see. If I didn't get up till 1 o'clock in the afternoon and I had a drink as soon as I woke up, does that count as morning or afternoon? You know, and I had a whole litany of them, and I wasn't trying to be funny. I wasn't trying to be oppositional. I just could not get it through my head. And so I spent the first 2 months believing that I was lying to you and taking advantage of your good nature, because you welcomed me. You gave me love and acceptance like I'd never had before. And so 2 months, almost to the day, I take my oldest daughter, who would have been the one to wake me up, I take my oldest daughter to her birthday dinner. Now, by this point, I was answering every one of those little questions except one. Two, excuse me, as yes. I'd never been able to identify having a blackout, and I'd never really had a craving, compulsion to drink. If I wanted to drink, I drank. Nobody said anything about it. But this time, I was completely drug-free and completely alcohol-free, and I go to dinner with my daughter, and it's early evening, and so we're the only people in the restaurant except one other customer, a man, at a table, just a little bit more than arm's length from where I was sitting. The wait person comes up this way, and as she comes walking through, she very quietly, slowly asks if we want anything to drink. And I say, oh, yes, I'll have a cup of coffee. My daughter will have a Coke. And she keeps going. And before she even got to the front part of our table, I was hit with a wave of wanting his drink. He had, it's got to have been Jack Daniel's Black Label, I swear to God, because I smelled it. I didn't even have a consciousness that I had smelled it. But I wanted that drink right then. And I went, oh, my God, what is that? And I started shaking, sweating down the side of my face, and I still didn't really recognize it. So I said, I got to go wash my hands. And as I go to the bathroom to wash my hands, I'm thinking, that is the fastest case of flu I've ever had it hit me. And I go in, and I'm washing my hands. And as I raised my head up to look into the mirror, I heard in my head, you're an alcoholic. You wanted his drink. You are an alcoholic. And I got to tell you, that was the best day of my life. And I've had some beautiful days in my life. But in that moment, I knew I was home. In that moment, I knew I never, ever had to suffer the way I had been suffering because of my drinking and using. I would like to say that I've never suffered badly since. That is not true. 45 years, 45, 46 years, whatever it is, 46 years, 46 years. You have a lot of living that you do. Our first baby, my husband, BJ, who's here with me tonight, our first baby didn't make it. She died right after birth, and it was his birthday. It was one of the hardest things I've had to experience. The second hard thing I had to experience was my birth mother had abandoned me and after me two more children. I was never, ever going to give my kids up. I was sober for almost 5 years, and I had to make that decision. I was no longer able to support them financially, and my husband had plenty of money. And I said, you have to take the children and raise them. And it was the hardest thing I would ever do. So suffering comes. Pain comes. Everybody's got a story. But that's all it is. It's just a story. And I am not my story. I am, as I stand before you, a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is the greatest thing that ever happened in my life. And it was beyond anything that I ever dreamed of. When I was a little girl, I remember dreaming in bed that I was going to be a movie star. I was going to grow up and be a movie star because everybody loves movie stars. Thank God I didn't go that route. But I'm going to tell you, that was what I was looking for forever, was that love and acceptance. And I felt that the very first time I walked into an open AA meeting as his date, Mr. AA. By the way, we broke up, and later on I met BJ. Well, I had barely met BJ at the time, and we fell in love. We are AA, what is it? boy and girl on the AA campus. Is that how they put it these days? And we've had our communication experiences to deal with and get through. Anyway, it's been quite a trip. I lost my job that I had worked so hard for through no fault of my own. And as a result of that, within days, I was offered a job at the local alcoholism clinic with absolutely not 1 hour of professional training. And the guy knew it. But I had been volunteering there for a while, and he had given me a part-time job eventually as a receptionist. And he had heard me talk with the women who brought their husbands, their DWI husbands, to go to classes there. They would come with their babies, and I would sit and talk with them in the waiting room while the guys were in doing the classes. I was just doing the program. I was just being who I was born to be, I guess. And I got offered this job, and I got sent to Minnesota to go to school. I got a complete scholarship to do that. If I'd had my children at the time, I couldn't have gone. So I've learned through experience that there is order and purpose in everything that comes my way. Some things I create, but mostly it's the things that I think in the moment are tragedies turned out to be some of the greatest blessings in my life. BJ and I were married for 25 years. We were in the field together. We had a business together. We helped a lot of people. We came here from Pennsylvania, and believe me, coming from Richmond, Virginia to Pennsylvania to Texas is quite a change, but we made it through, and I'm glad that we're in Texas. I can't imagine living anywhere else at this point. But in 2000, we divorced. We loved each other, but we could no longer live with each other. It was a very lonely time from 2000 until Christmas last year, and what happened? He pissed me off, and I told him, and I was certain I was right. But something happened in that moment of me being in charge, me taking control of what was happening in the family. And we began to talk, and we are today working on reconciling. After 17 years of being not married, and today I consider myself married, but the law doesn't. So I'm living in sin, and I'm enjoying every minute of it. I don't know if that's a good thing to say in here. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody else, but it's working for us. So, in my recovery, I not only have worked in the field, but I have done nothing. I have done lots and lots of service work. I was kind of hoping, since it's an alumni meeting, that somebody would be here that I got to meet a year, 2 years ago. I started doing the women's meetings next door every other Thursday night. I would do that AA meeting over there, but I'm afraid I don't see any faces that I remember from that time. But I've always done a lot of service work. I do believe strongly in it. But of all the things that I can walk away with, that I can tell you I would never, ever give up at this point, is my God. I want to tell you about a little bit about my God. I have 10 more minutes. When I walked into AA and Al-Anon, it wasn't that I was an atheist and I said, there is no God. I knew there was a God and he was a son of a bitch. I hope that doesn't offend anyone, but that was my attitude. I was angry and hurt, and I wanted nothing to do with the spiritual side of this program. Through a series of different things, I was encouraged to start looking for a God, a higher power, that I could at least have a decent conversation with. I was encouraged to sit down first thing in the morning and just tell my God, my higher power, all the things I was upset with him about. And after a while, somehow, whoever it was or whatever it was I was talking to gentled me down. I don't know any other way to say it. But I became a gentle woman, and I had been looking for that forever. I'd given up. You might call it a lady, but I call it a gentle woman. And little by little, the things that were happening in my life reinforced that there is goodness and love, and it is in every single cell of my body. I believe that I was no damn good. I'd been told that my whole life growing up, and my only salvation would be if I would do just what she wanted me to do and what my daddy wanted me to do, I might redeem myself enough to live in the human race. And I bought that. It went deep. But I heard people that taught me how to think differently. And out of learning to think differently, I began to learn how to choose what I was going to think next. I learned about triggers and what I could do with them. I can choose to think about something else. That was a new thing to me. I thought I had to think what my parents thought, what the government thought, what the teachers thought, and I rebelled against all of it and was constantly in trouble. I never learned to develop an open mind. All I did was get up in the morning, and while I'm sitting on the potty, my throne, talk to higher power, tell them what I was pissed off about. And then after a while, I started saying, but, you know, yeah, that happened, but, you know, well, out of that, I got a new car. Or, you know, I guess it's not quite as bad as it seems. I began to develop a sense of gratitude that was genuine. I could pretend that I was grateful about something, and you would have bought it because I was a hell of an actress. But I didn't feel it. But as I began to just simply sit down and talk, then I wanted to read literature and sit quietly. And then I wanted to learn some prayers. And I did. And then I wanted to know about this thing called higher power, universal spirit, whatever your choice is. And yes, I was told about the doorknob. And, you know, okay, I tried it. I was willing to try, at that point, I was willing to try anything because I, on the outside, looked great. And on the inside, I was still a scared little four-year-old. I began to learn more and more about all the various religions of the world. I began to learn that the basic principles that we operate by, there's nothing new here. They've been inscribed on stone back during Zoroastrians. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But that's the first civilized people that wrote things down. And it's right there. And all the great teachers since have taught the same basic ideas of what principles are and how to live by them. And then I took a physics course, and I learned all about how the laws scientifically of physics are proving out a lot of these principles that we've all thought were spiritual. And they are. They're spiritual in nature, but science is beginning to catch up. And I thought that was so cool. So for a long time, that's what I did. And over a period of time, my God is my best friend. My God is not a man or a woman or a thing. My God is all of you, as I look in your eyes, as I feel the energy in this room, as I look at my husband, and those of you who I have only met just this evening, that is my God. That is my love. People call it different things, but I call it love. I have learned physically that there are interesting things happening when they split those atoms. Every time they split those atoms and make them into smaller and smaller pieces, at the center is light, and they cannot measure the light. And they keep splitting what's left, smaller and smaller, and it's always light. And I think that when I see the light in your eyes of what sobriety is bringing you, the hope, I get goosebumps. That's what makes us all one. And not only in this room, but I got to go to the last, when they had the international in San Antonio, I sat in that auditorium and I felt the energy of all those people. I feel your energy right now. And I'm hooked on it. And it's a heck of a lot better than being hooked on those other things that were destroying me, that were drowning me. I feel very, very honored for being asked to come out here tonight, and I thank you very much, Chris, for calling and asking me. I would like to close with the second part of the Serenity Prayer. We all know the first part. The second part reads, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as a pathway to peace. Accepting this world or taking this world as it is and not as I would have it. Trusting that God will set all things right if I surrender my will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy in the next. Thank you very much.